From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. James Rebanks learned shepherding from his father and grandfather in Cumbria in northern England. His family has been farming for 600 years, maybe more, in the region. He grew up, went off, and was soon back to the farm and its sheep, started tweeting about it, and was deluged with followers. There's something in that life that people want. Now he's writing about it. This hour on Point, James Rebanks on The Shepherd's Life. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this your life, your dream, or something like it? Do you think you'd really like it? The work, the stillness? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Cumbria, from the town of Carlisle in the UK, is James Rebanks. His family farm there has 500 or 1,000 sheep, depending on the time of year. James has written a kind of memoir of the work and life and his family's history there. It is The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Land. New York Times calls it captivating. Lots of raving about this book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also find a gallery of photos from James' Twitter account. James Rebanks, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. There's been such an amazing response, first to your Twitter feed, then a piece you had in The Atlantic a couple of years back, and now to this book about very, in some ways, the simple and subtle but rudiments of farming and shepherding. What do you think has so many people in the year 2015 keyed up and ready to dive in and relish this kind of story, James?
I think people are more and more aware with every passing year how disconnected they are from farming and food and from the countryside around the cities, etc. And I think there are moments like with my book where that comes to the fore and people realize that there are still people doing what their grandfathers did or their great grandfathers did, and it offers a different perspective on the world. And I think people are fascinated that we still farm in such an old-fashioned way, and a lot of people wish they could have part of that or share it in some way.
I want to get an intimate feeling for what this is like. You've got a passage here where your father was shearing a sheep, or clipping, you call it, to get the wool. And I love it because you get a sense of this interaction of humans and sheep, shepherd and sheep, and just how intimate it gets, how well the shepherd knows the sheep and how they're going to respond. Your dad is out and he's wearing moccasins because he wants that real sort of foot feel for everything about the ground and the sheep, because it's very intimate when you grab a sheep and sort of turn it on its rump and begin to shear. Would you set it up and read for us a bit, James?
Of course. Dad's t-shirt is wet with sweat. He straightens his back occasionally as if it aches. He catches the sheep from a pen and turns it with a twist of its neck over his leg onto its bum. His hand reaches up and pulls the rope, one shiny silver with use, that starts the motor. The other hand tucks the ewe's leg behind his bum and picks up the clipper handpiece. The stomach is clipped first, with a hand reaching down to protect the teats or the penis. Then the wool on the back leg is opened out round to the tail and the backbone. The machine sweeps the fleece in successive blows of the arm from the sheep's bodies. Dad is like a machine, the sheep sort of entranced by his movement, an all-consuming dance between him and the sheep. It is a carefully choreographed thing in which the sheep is turned, shuffled and rolled in clever, purposeful ways so that each sweep of the shears takes a full clipper comb width of wool from the body, with that part of the body stretched safely so there is no vulnerable clefts of skin caught and cut by the shears. The ewes are ready for clipping, so the fleece rises from the skin, lifting away from the body, with the comb of electronic shears gathering it in, and the cutter cutting it cleanly and neatly from the body. The ewe loses its fleece without stress and is back with its lambs before it knows what is happening.
It's a beautiful passage. It catches it so well. It's funny. I actually grew up myself raising sheep, and this passage brought it back so vividly, shearing time and the way all that goes, and just how deft and rapid someone who's very experienced in shearing can be, how well they know the sheep's body, the suppleness of the
the flesh under the wool, how to keep it from nicking, as you say, or cutting anywhere, that interaction. It's a marvelous dent. You describe it beautifully there.
Oh, thank you. I should add that it isn't just beautiful and poetic. There's another side to shearing sheep, which is it's backbreaking if you're not very good at it. So I also describe being young in the book and trying to keep up with my father and failing when I was maybe 20 years old and cursing it and having a bad back.
So, your dad could shear, you said, maybe 200 sheep in a day. A beginner would be far short of that and maybe in tears in the corner after one or two.
50 usually finishes off most people if they're not used to it, yeah.
Yeah. Michiko Kakutani of your book says this book is about, in a way, about continuity and roots and a sense of belonging in an age it's increasingly about mobility and self-invention. There is deep continuity here. Your family goes back almost beyond recorded time here. How can that be? How have you stayed so long?
We're not very adventurous. We like where we're at, so we don't go anywhere. But the oldest written record we've got for my family is in the neighboring parish about 3 miles away, and that's in 1420. But to be honest, we don't pay very much attention to that because that's just the written paperwork, and we're not really a family that features much in the paperwork. So the assumption is maybe we were there for much longer than that, maybe 1,000 years, maybe 2,000 years, who knows, way longer than the written record.
If people picture a map or the terrain of the United Kingdom, you're way northwest in England, Cumbria, right up next near to Scotland there. Describe the terrain for us. It's called the Lake Country. The terrain and the very interesting literary history that actually has a real world impact on you and your farm even today.
Yeah, we're basically from the fell. Fell's our word from sort of mountain or moorland. From the fell behind our house, we look across the Solway, which is an estuary to Scotland, so it's literally within sight. And the Lake District is basically 800 square miles of hill country in the north. It's the poet William Wordsworth described it as 13 valleys like the spokes of a wheel. He wrote a piece of writing in which he stood on the sort of centre of those spokes. And it's probably the most iconic piece of landscape in the English language. So it's been written about extensively for 250 years. And it's trying to become a World Heritage Site at the moment because of what my ancestors did, the sort of sheep, the unique kind of sheep farming that's there, but also because it changed the world. So the poet William Wordsworth said about our landscape that everybody who had an eye to see or a heart to feel should have a sort of stake in it. And that's, in many ways, is where every national park, every national trust, every protected historic property in the world comes from, those words. That's sort of part of the DNA of everything historic protected around the world. And it was unique because it was so close to the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. So within 2 hours of where I live was the birthplace in Lancashire and Manchester. Of the sort of industrial world. And so where we live became one of the first places where people came and said, hang on a minute, we need to protect this. This is beautiful and special, and it's in all of our interest to not let these places change and become industrial.
Because it was so close and yet so far. You write that about until around 1750, no one from the outside world had paid much attention to your mountainous corner, northwest England. And when they had, you write, they found it to be poor, unproductive, primitive, harsh, ugly, backwards.
People like Defoe came before it became fashionable, and they thought it was the back end of nowhere. And it was a very poor place, and it was very difficult to get to, although it's very, very close now with modern roads and railways, etc. Before roads were built in the sort of mid-18th century, it was a very inaccessible place, so it literally took days to get there from London, etc. So it suddenly became accessible around about the time that Britain was modernising. And where we live is really special. But it had a unique kind of conservation that emerged here as well, which wasn't just about protecting a wilderness, as many of the North American national parks are. Here it was very much about protecting a cultural landscape, a place that people had shaped over millennia before that.
Your ancestors. Wordsworth writing, toward the head of these dales was found a perfect republic of shepherds and agriculturalists. Neither knight nor esquire nor highborn nobleman was here, but many of these humble sons of the hills had a consciousness that the land which they walked over and tilled had for more than 500 years been possessed by men of their name and blood. He found a kind of what you described as idealized landscape of the mind, but sometimes not paying enough real attention to those agriculturalists, those shepherds by your young lights.
Yeah, I think one of the things I think really where the book came from is as a teenager, I realized that there were two kinds of love of our landscape going on. There's sort of high literature one for, in Wordsworth and in the minds of many other English people and people around the world coming who wanted to be scenic and beautiful and a place of leisure and escape. And then there was the way that my father, my grandfather, and maybe 200 or 300 other farming families around us thought about it. And I thought those two things were very different. One was about our view of it was as a working landscape, a people's landscape. And I think through my life, people have increasingly started to forget that it has a really unique people history and that the things that are beautiful about it are man-made. And that makes it quite different from a North American national park like Yellowstone or somewhere where the beauty and the specialness and the uniqueness is natural or ecological.
You know, it's funny. I get so homesick around lambing time every year. Lately, I've started to go on Twitter and look for photographs of fresh-born lambs just because it's so satisfying as a kid who grew up with them and birthing them and all the rest. And I actually ran across your tweet without knowing anything about the rest of this, your Twitter feed, and have enjoyed it for some time, just vicariously. I'm clearly not the only one. There is a hunger out there for that kind of real closeness to the land and animals, livestock that you're living in, that you're describing, James.
Yeah, I think so. I think in the modern age where you go to a supermarket, you pick your food up, and you increasingly have no contact with farmers, I think there's a very great demand to be able to see what's actually going on the farm. So me posting pictures of lambs as they're born, it's very direct, and I think people like that. They feel like they're getting a glimpse behind the scenes of our life.
Also, a reality check in this book and beyond, that this is a lot of work, and it's real work. Love that sound. James Rebax, please stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shepherd's life, the old agricultural life, far from the city, the old ways in the midst of the new. James Rebanks became well-known tweeting images from his farm in northern England, Cumbria. Now he's written a memoir, a history of that life that has everybody talking. The book is The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And here's a little sound. This is of Herdwick lambs, the breed he raises. And the wind blowing through Cumbria right there. You can join us this hour. Do you dream of a little farm in the hills? Are you doing it right now? Is it so dreamy? Is it hard? And what's your question for James Rebanks on the shepherd's life, the sheep, the lambs, the birthing, the land? What about the economics? Could you make a go of it? And are we cut off from something that we need? Land, animals, natural cycles, nature, interconnectedness, community, sense of life handed down through generations. James Rebanks joins us from the north of England in Cumbria. Introduce us to your breed, the Herdwick. And I wish you'd just describe them physically first. It's quite a striking breed of sheep with that very white head and face. And then the rather densely colored body of wool.
Yeah, they're, as everybody knows, they're the greatest breed of sheep in the world.
Wait a minute.
To say that so that I can go home. Okay. The local myth is that these are the sheep that the Vikings brought to the north of England about 1,000 years ago. And none of us knew whether that was true or not, but there was some science done a couple of years ago into the genetics of those sheep, and their nearest relatives are on the islands right up the sort of side of the Atlantic and the North Sea, and basically confirms what we'd always said, which is that they came on boats with the Vikings. But in terms of how they look, they're the toughest mountain sheep in Britain, maybe in Europe, and their job is to survive on some of the wettest and coldest mountains that exist, where it would not be unusual for it to rain every day for 50 days, and cold rain as well. And so their features basically have the white head and white legs, and they have a really hard, dark blue, wiry coat that the water runs off very quickly, and which has sort of two layers. The bottom layer keeps them very warm, so they're never cold. You know, we're on the mountains freezing, and the sheep are absolutely fine.
You say blue. I see some of that, but sometimes looks russet to me almost.
Well, the russet isn't natural. We have a whole bunch of traditions to do with our Herdwick sheep. Some of them so old that nobody knows quite why we do those things. But one of those traditions is that when they're shown at the shepherd's meets, which is like the gathering where we compete with each other, we put a kind of red paste on the back, which is from the iron ore in the mountains.
And you're like the original punk rockers, a little henna going on up there.
Well, they've got a rebellious streak in them, so maybe they are punk sheep. And there's a bunch of theories for that. So one of the theories is it goes back so far, it's a sort of Celtic thing. It was like a sort of spiritual, animistic thing that we worshipped them in some way. Perhaps a more likely explanation is that this was something done to the best sheep in the flock, so that you could, basically you colored them with the brightest color that you had, so you could see them on the mountain. And when you came out in the morning, if you saw the bright red sheep, you knew that your expensive ram or tup was safe, and you could go about your day a little bit with a bit more peace of mind. So
got it. Now, your rams or bucks, as we would call them, or tups, as you call them, also they're horned. It's a small curled horn, but definitely a horned.
Yeah, but I should explain. Half of them have horns, and the other half don't. And it's not considered a major sort of good point or bad point either way. Mm-hmm. As long as the white is very, very white, and as long as they have the right attributes to survive in our landscape, we judge them on other things. So the horns are more incidental.
Yeah. It's a pretty big sheep. The head's right up near a man's belly when you're showing. I mean, the head.
They're very big sheep. They're very impressive sheep for mountain sheep. People think hearing about sort of fellow mountain sheep might be thinking scrawny, goat-looking things, but best of these are some of the best sheep in England.
We're going to dig in and hear about the life, the seasons of shepherding in Cumbria in the north of England. James Rebanks has written about it in his new book, The Shepherd's Life, getting rave reviews. People kind of longing for that. Maybe you're longing for it, or maybe you're living it and know the work side of this. He writes in here, he says, tough work knocks the silliness out of you when you grow up in places like ours. It teaches you to get tougher or get lost. And I know from youth exactly what you mean by that. Brian in Avon, New York, you're on the air with James Rebanks in Cumbria in England. Thank you for calling, Brian. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. I'm living the dream. I also lived the horror, too. That was information technology for 10 years, and that job dang near killed me, so I made the jump, and I'm calling you live from my fields with my goats.
Fantastic. It's great to hear, Brian. Great to hear.
So you were a coder or something. You were in computers, and now you're in goats?
I'm in goats. I'm a new small farmer. I got 6 goats. I got 4 pigs. I'm getting cattle this weekend. I got chickens. I got rabbits, but it's a mixed bag, but it's rewarding. It really is. I have a number of friends who are still in the coding and computer industry, and they love hearing my stories and my pictures. And I tell them, you know, yeah, it's hard physical work, yes, but, you know, you get used to it. And it's to a point where now I understand what they mean by Amish strong.
You know, I don't know how long you've been in it. James' family's been in it since 1420, maybe longer. How long have you done it now, Brian? And do you think it's really for you, or is this just a kind of walk in the park and you'll be back in your cubicle?
Oh no, this is year 3 for me, so I'm brand spanking new to this. Yeah. I'm just a babe, but I've been trying to do. No, it's much more rewarding. I cannot imagine. A friend of mine asked me the same question. He's like, "Can you go back to the IT world?" I was like, "I can't do the program management schedules, the senseless, mindless meetings where everyone just sits around and." You know, they talk about their next meeting that they're going to have.
Can you really make a living at it with your 6 goats and 2 cattle and a couple of pigs? I mean, even James works on the side as a advisor to UNESCO on sustainable tourism. He's got a little other income there. What about you, Brian? Can you make a go of it?
My wife she works full time, so that's the outside income that's coming in.
Patron.
I had a substantial matron nest egg saved up.
Yeah.
And I'm the one who's financing. We pay everything for this cash. Everything's cash, so you don't have to worry about that. But well, as with any business, you know, in your first couple of years, you're going to be a little bit in the red, and then you're going to see a break-even point, and then from there on, I hope to be in the black.
Can I just jump
yes,
in there, Tom? I think there's a really important point here. I think it'd be a bit naive to think that everybody could be a shepherd in the mountains, but I don't think that's really the point. I think the point is to have some kind of contact with food or with the land or or the people that produce your food is inherently a good thing. It's just healthy for society. It's healthy for people to know more about their food, to question the people that produce it about how it's produced. It's the distance we have from our food in the modern world that's corrosive, I think. So I wouldn't for a second suggest that everybody could make a living in the hills with sheep. As you say, I have to do other things to pay the bills as well. So my point was more to tell people why you might want to have more involvement with the land and what it means to people like us that still have.
And lots of people really responding to that. Brian in New York, Ava, New York, good luck, Brian, with your new venture there. 3 years in now, that's not bad. Johnny in Isle of Mott, Vermont. Johnny, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're a female Johnny. Nice to have you, female Johnny.
I am. I'm actually Johnny-Eve.
Johnny-Eve. Oh, great. Yes. What's your story, Johnny-Eve?
I'm also a farmer. I'm doing some migratory labor on farms this summer, but I've been farming for about 12 years. And I just wanted to say that I really love the passage that you read, but I'm glad that the romanticism is tempered with reality. Yeah. I worry that agricultural work is getting a bit overly romanticized, and you know, the reality is that it's supremely gratifying, but it's also really hard work.
Yeah, I reassure you on that. One of the things I wanted to do when I was asked to write the book was, yes, explain the beautiful bits, but also explain the gritty, hard bits. And rest assured, they're in my book. So I talk about things that die. I talk about the tough days in winter when your hands are freezing, and it's really nasty, and you still have to do your duty and look after your animals. And I also talk about the difficulty, which many farming families will recognize, of the generations, the tensions between fathers and sons. And in the 2 years while I was writing the book, my father sadly was dying of cancer. And quite a lot of the book is about the tensions when I was young between myself and my father, and then coming through those things as I grew up and he got older, and we found a sort of friendship and a peace through that.
The tensions, because there's a lot of work to be done, and the parent ends up imposing or demanding, requiring that work, a lot of that work of the child, in your case, the son.
Yeah, I think it's partly that, but to be fair to my old man, I think it's as much the fault on the younger generation as that every 20-year-old man or woman on a farm thinks they should be the boss right away now, and
yes.
That isn't
right.
Always possible. So right. in defense of my dad, I think I might have been the problem, not him.
Yeah, entirely possible. Take us through the seasons of that work and that relationship, interaction between shepherd and sheep. I don't know what season you prefer to begin in, but I wish you'd walk us through the sort of work and sheep shepherd calendar of the year, James Rebanks.
Yeah, no problem. So I guess in my head, the year starts with when we put the tups or the rams with the ewes. We would do that on the 5th, between the 5th and the 10th of November, depending on the weather. And then from the minute the tups are in with the ewes, the sort of clock is counting. So you're basically 5 months until the lambs come.
Don't skip over that too quickly. It's interesting. Okay. We did it earlier. Maybe your winters were colder than mine growing up in Illinois. Ours were more late summer. But that was a big moment because, of course, that will be the breeding. The rams only in with the ewes when they're breeding, at least in our flocks. So you don't want the ram knocking you over, and he will.
That's basically 6 weeks of the year. So there'll be a lot of guys listening to this think it's a perfect life because a tup would basically get 100 wives. He mates with them all in a period of about a month to 6 weeks.
Only when they're ready. They don't let him otherwise, right?
Yeah, so he runs around what is a very big field, sniffing behind every single one of them several times a day. It sounds fun, but you look at them after about 6 weeks and they're exhausted. I mean, some of them are almost almost finished.
I would come out in the morning or sometimes late in the day, and the ram would be sitting down. His hind legs would be so exhausted from that work.
So they get exhausted, and it literally takes them weeks and weeks and weeks to recover.
Yeah, it's funny.
But through winter, our work is fairly simple. We're down to the core flock. So the pattern of our farming system is that the grass in the mountains between April and October is used to grow a crop of surplus lambs that we would sell on in the autumn. Mm-hmm. So through the winter, we're down to just the core flock, and come rain, hail, snow, whatever we get, our job is to feed all of those sheep every day, and if they need feeding when there's no grass, and to look after them, particularly as they're becoming increasingly pregnant through to April.
James, are yours always out in the elements? I couldn't tell from your photographs. We would use the barn a lot in the deep cold of winter, but yours seem to be out a lot.
Yeah, Herdwick sheep are outside sheep. They... Mm-hmm. They, a lot of them don't even come down into the valley bottom fields. They actually live on the mountain all year round.
Wow.
And they, they're very, in terms of their breeding and their genetics, they're very old-fashioned. They don't actually like being inside. They don't like piped water. They're as stubborn and independent and cussed as we are. So they like to be where they are. So April, from April to the middle of May, the period we've just gone through is when we lamb our sheep, and that's probably the busiest days of the year. We lamb them all outside in the fields. Many of them can lamb themselves, but of course you don't know which ones are going to lamb themselves, so you're doing a constant loop monitoring the situation and trying to solve any problems that arise.
Are all of your ewes marked by the buck when they're bred with the crayon there on the chest so you know what day they're likely to lamb?
Absolutely. We change the color. We call it rattle that we put on their chest. We don't use the cranes. We catch the rams each day and we put an oily paste called rattle on their chests.
Okay.
So, you can tell which ones are going to give birth in each sort of cycle of 16 days.
And you're talking, in your case, several hundred lambs.
Yeah, we've just had just over 500 lambs in the last 6 weeks.
So. That's a lot. And I think many people might be surprised at how much attention it takes. I mean, yes, sheep can often do it on their own, but perhaps it's because they've been herded, kept by humans for so long. Many fail without intervention.
Yeah, by about mid-May, I'm about worn out usually because you're doing sort of 18, sometimes 20-hour days, and a lot of things can go wrong. So you might have a young ewe might give birth and then something might upset it, maybe a fox or, I don't know, a walker goes past and maybe she just gets a little bit agitated and upset. And the sheep's sort of survival mechanism sometimes tells it if the weather comes really bad that it might be better to leave the lamb and just survive itself. So there's a whole bunch of things can happen that make work. And a shepherd's job is to spot those things.
Or just the birth. If the lamb isn't coming out right with both of its hooves underneath its chin up there, you've got to sometimes push it back in, get the legs arranged, be sort of in up to your elbow, getting things ready to emerge.
Absolutely. So hopefully, I like to think I do my job well, but if I've done my job well, then there'd be dozens and dozens of lambs on our place now running around that wouldn't have been here if I hadn't have worked my backside off for the last 6 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you've got your very young lambs. They're out. Do you have predators in Cumbria? Do you have to worry about that?
We have smaller predators. We don't have coyotes. We don't have bears. We don't have wolves. We haven't had those things for many hundreds of years. There's a lively debate about whether we should reintroduce those things into our landscape, which I understand. I understand why people might want some wilder places. I think the smallness and the sort of isolated nature of our particular landscape means that it's probably not a great idea to do those things in close proximity to sort of existing historically important farming system. But we do have things like foxes and badgers, which from time to time will take lambs. In fact, this spring we lost about half a dozen lambs over a couple of days to a fox, and many of our neighbours did to other predators. So those are some of the extra challenges that you have. And then as of about 2 weeks ago, we take the sheep back to the mountains with their 3- and 4-week-old lambs, and they go back to the mountain. And one of the things that's special about our farming system is that the sheep go to the mountains where there are no fences. And on our fell stroke mountain, there are 10 different flocks of sheep taken back up there from 10 different farms. And they hold they hold very, very tightly to the place where they always go back to. And the word we use is hefted.
Yes. And they're hefted to that land, to that
hefted
sort
to
of
that land. So
in the mountain.
So my sheep could wander 20 miles away from where they actually are, but 99% of them won't because their shepherds historically taught them to live on one part of the mountain, and now they will live nowhere else. In fact, they're deeply unhappy until they get back to that place.
You talk about continuity. That makes the breed line very important. If you suddenly interrupted it, got rid of those ewes, didn't have them passing that on, they'd wander all over the place.
Yeah, and again, another unique thing about our farming system is that when the farmer leaves the farm, he has to leave the core breeding flock in place because those sheep are hefted to a particular part of the mountain. As you say, if he sold them and somebody brought some new sheep in, they wouldn't work at all. So the flocks of sheep are literally amazing because the mother has taught the lamb to live on that part of the mountain every single spring going back, we think, 3,000 or 4,000 years. So the flocks are not only fascinating in a genetic sense, but they're an amazing cultural achievement. Those flocks of sheep are like as old as the pyramids. It's amazing.
James Rebanks, it's so wonderful to have you with us from Cumbria today in the far north of England, talking about the Lake District the shepherding life there. The new book is The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape. Grew out of tweets, and now it's kind of a sensation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. James, stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Little sheep shearing there, that in Nova Scotia, far from Cumbria, where my guest farms and raises sheep. James Rebanks is with us. His new book is The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape. And it is a wonderful tale of family history, of regional history and literature and lore, a way of life, and a real working life in sheep that he has chosen. Lots of response, James, online here. Yolanta says, it's being close to nature that can bring us close to our inner self and the feeling of fulfillment. She's all for it. Another listener here says, my grandma's family were sheep herders in New Mexico. History lost when she moved to L.A. It's easy for that to be lost, James. It's kind of amazing that your family has stayed all this time. Of course, it's not everyone, you remind us. You've got lots of siblings along the way in every generation who peel off.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just discovered in the last week, actually, where I had to very briefly pop over to Canada to launch the book there, and we found some relatives that had done exactly that a couple of generations ago. So, not everybody can do it. Not everybody wants to do it, and that's absolutely fine. I think the thing that really my passion was to tell everybody why it still matters and why it's still special and why it's still important. And I think it's really important that older ways of life survive around us. I don't think anybody really wants the world to be all concrete, all new, all glass, all aluminium. There are places where we like older things to survive, and it makes life more interesting. It makes food more interesting. A lot of the world's great food products are created in quite old-fashioned ways, but that's part of what's special about them.
So. But it's not easy to keep it going and keep it in the family. You know, my family, it's almost 200 years now on the same farm there. They settled that land in Illinois, 7 generations, which for the United States is a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
My cousin Steve farming there. But, you know, we had almost 100 years where there were single children, so the farm was never broken up. You know, my grandmother and mother were both the only children. Without that, how do you keep it from being broken up as, you know, siblings claim their bit and pretty soon it's in pieces?
Yeah, that happens. The truth is the families just do the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
So in my family, I'm the oldest son. So we go through that with each generation. You try and balance keeping the farm going with being fair to the other siblings, and that's not easy for anybody. If they're thinking about their children, that's very difficult. But the other thing that happened here, which has helped enormously, is that various wealthy people like Beatrix Potter, the writer, the Peter the Rabbit author.
Yes.
She fell in love with our landscape when she was a child, and when she made all her money from her books, came back to it, and she bought many of the farms. She bought, I think, something like 15 farms, 4,000 acres, and many of the flocks are in situ in the mountains. And she insisted in her will when she left them to the National Trust that they would sustain that system, that farming system. So many of my friends and colleagues that are shepherds in the Lake District are on those farms that were left by people like that. And they become tenants of those farms. They farm them for their working life. And then they would either pass them on to their sons or daughters, or some other tenant would come in and keep it going. So that's helped as well. That's one of the other reasons why it's so unique and so special, and why something so old has survived in the middle of modern Britain.
It's good luck for you. National Trust land. You don't own all the land in the mountains. You sort of rent what you call the stint there, your piece.
Yeah, well, that's another crazy thing. The mountains originally weren't considered to be worth much. They were what in England they call manorial waste, which is basically the lord of the manor didn't give a monkeys about those bits. So the peasants, if you like, my ancestors, were allowed to take their sheep into those mountains in return for occasionally bearing arms and fighting against the Scots. I think that was the deal.
Yeah. No.
And over time, they reached a point maybe 200 or 300 years ago where we simply refused to fight anymore in return for grazing those mountains. But we kept the legal right to take a certain number of sheep into those fells. So some of those mountains still belong to the descendants of those aristocrats in the past. But they, in many cases, don't own any of the rights to graze their sheep on the mountains. So the peasants won, basically. We have sort of ancient, legal, protected rights that say that we can take our sheep into their mountains and graze them, and that's what we do.
We've got to be careful talking about fighting with the Scots. My engineer on the other side of the glass is Scottish James. I don't want to get all up in arms here.
Let me be clear. We refused to fight the Scots. It was the aristocrats.
Yeah, right. You've got a listener who says, I don't think I could do it, only because I'm always a little nervous to be so alone in the middle of nowhere. That's always where crazy axe murderers chop people up and stuff.
In my experience, it isn't in the mountains where the crazy axe murderers
are. I don't think so either. In fact, I love the sense of community that you get across here. There's a bit I wish you'd read of your grandfather, sort of what he passed down to you. What was expected in this community of your family, your way?
Okay. My grandfather is asleep in an old brown armchair that is for his use and his use only. He's read the local newspaper and fallen asleep in it after his midday meal. He's old and tired because he starts early and works too hard for an old man, but I wish he would wake up. Sometimes when he's not working, he tells me stories. He loves to tell stories, true stories. This is how he passes on his values, how he tells me who we are. They have morals, these stories. We don't give up, even when things are bad. We pay our debts. We work hard. We act decently. We help our neighbours if they need it. We do what we say we will do. We don't want much attention. We look after our own. We're proud of what we do. We try to be quietly smart. We take chances sometimes to get on. We will fail sometimes. We will be affected by the wider world, but we hold on to who we are. It was clear from his stories that we were part of a tradition that long predated us and would long exist after us. The stories left you feeling proud to be part of that tradition, but very aware that as individuals we were bound by duty to carry it on, bound to try and live by those values. His main lesson was above all to get along with people. Don't burn your bridges, or they will stay down for a long time. Having the same families live and work alongside each other for many centuries created a unique kind of society with special values. In my grandfather's world, a person's life was not a thing of his own invention, a new thing on a blank slate. We are bound by our landscape, shaped by it, defined by it. Like all good grandparents, my grandfather could only see the best in me, and that always made me stand a little taller.
James Rebanks, reading from his new book, The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape. Expectations there of how people would live. Crawford in New Orleans, Louisiana. Crawford, thank you for calling. You're on the air with James Rebanks.
Hi, Tom, James. Hey, I'm calling. I'm from also from a line of shepherd, but of a different type. Come from a line of pastors, actually. And
okay.
I get just tickled listening to you speak of the deep care you take of the sheep, and can't help but think of the metaphor of the good shepherd that comes up in the Bible. And I'm just curious of if you've ever thought of that, of the comparison between the care God has for his sheep and the way you take care of your sheep, and just any reflections you might have on that allegory. Yeah.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. How about it, James?
I entirely understand the metaphor, and if I'm honest, there's nothing affects me quite as much as when you're at a funeral of a shepherd here, and when they sing those old psalms or hymns that are about shepherds, and you're surrounded by rough, tough shepherds, and I'm thinking particularly of my own father's funeral at the end of February, and you see some very hard men crying at those hymns because they mean something particular to us, then it's very touching, and you're very aware that that Christianity is steeped in sort of shepherding knowledge and law and values. So, yeah.
Powerful metaphor. No question about that. Becky in Moncton, Vermont. Becky, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm so excited that you're doing a program on sheep.
Me too. Me too. I can't get over it.
It's a revolution. It started, everybody.
Oh, boy. What do you know, Becky?
Well, I wanted to talk about how smart sheep are, because that's been touched on but not quite elaborated, and so many people think sheep are dumb and use that metaphor. They use the metaphor of sheep as being not smart, when in fact they're very intelligent they're herd animals, for sure, and that's how they protect themselves. But they remember people, they remember faces. Our sheep have really full personalities. Each one is different. They know their names. They come when called. They know other words. So we've learned so much from keeping our sheep, and one of the things we've learned is how incredibly smart they are.
I'm glad you raised that, Becky, and the personalities. There is no doubt of that. James, you write about it as well. These are not just faceless creatures in a flock, especially the lead sheep in any group. They have very distinctive personalities. I grew up thinking of them as a community almost of humans in their subtlety.
No, they're. I couldn't agree more with the caller. They're sheep are really smart. What many people are used to, actually, is that some of the more improved, sort of highly improved, highly selectively bred modern sheep that have extreme carcasses, sometimes I think maybe are less intelligent. But when you're in more natural, more primitive, to use the word that scientists mm-hmm. would use, breeds, mm-hmm. they're still really, really street smart. So our sheep are. They're super smart about the weather. They're super smart about where they should be. The idea that you could sort of trick them with because they're dumb is completely misplaced. And most of that language about them being sort of dumb animals that just flock together and don't think of things through is misplaced by people that don't really know about sheep, I think.
James, stand by there in Cumbria. We have another sheep breeder. Small scale, but for real. Peggy Allen joins us from Hartford, Vermont. She's co-owner with her husband, Todd, of Savage Heart Farm in Hartford. 42 sheep in business 3 years this August, came out of, and still maybe a foot in business backgrounds, broadcasting and management consulting. They've got Corriedale and Cormo sheep. Peggy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's been just a delight to listen to James describe what his family has been doing all these years. I'm only 3 years into it, but it has been one of the most extraordinary adventures.
I don't know how it all sounds or has been to you, but do you have culture shock getting into it? Have you tiptoed into it gently enough that it's all right? Are you overwhelmed sometimes?
We did not tiptoe in any way. A Labor Day weekend, we were on vacation in the San Juan Islands and came across a 75-year-old Annette with her small flock. And my husband said to Annette, "You're living my wife's dream. I've always loved sheep fiber." And got a spinning wheel right out of college and would drag my husband to sheep farms in Wisconsin looking for fleece. And he always said, "You would be so bored being a shepherd." And on that Labor Day weekend in 2011, we made the decision because of Annette's conversation with us. And 12 months later, we had sold our suburban house in Chicago. I'd convinced my boss at ABC to let me move my job to a hillside in Vermont. We looked at 40 properties. We got our flock on what I think is the best breed ever, James, the Corriedale.
Oh, no. Now we start another fight.
Yeah, right. And
you can have second, baby.
But again, we're raising them for their fiber, and it's just been the most rewarding experience. And we've knew nothing. We got the sheep books for dummies, and we're off to the races. But without the support of folks who've been doing sheep in the area here for over 20-plus years, they've really mentored us. And we just went through our third lambing season. We had 18 lambs, 5 sets of twins, 2 sets of triplets.
Yeah.
Like James said, we lost some, and it was heartbreaking. But we were there to help when we needed to step in and help. And mm-hmm. I think the other thing we recognized is it's one thing to get them out alive. It's another to know that you've got a good mom who's yeah. going to take care.
Yeah.
And we've witnessed some really bad parenting. So we have, a bottle baby, Tinkerbell, because the mom wanted nothing to do with the baby, and we will not breed that mom again. It's been quite the learning curve.
Choices to make. My cousin, second cousin, Bob Gillis, raised Corriedale. Very handsome sheep, tremendous wool. What's your advice to people thinking about, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll get out of the city and modernity and dive into all that, Peggy?
One of the best things we did was the largest association gathering is in Maryland the first Saturday in May, the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival, and every breed in the United States is there. And it's very fun. You'll be there talking to the association that breeds Finn, and you'll think, Finn is the way to go. And you get to the next booth, and then you think, Tunis. Tunis is the way to go. And you say, well, what about the Finn? And they'll say, sure, if you like foot rot. It's just very funny how people who want one particular breed to expand in the United States sort of diss the next breed. But that's where you you meet people who've been doing it for a long time. You can see what all the different breeds are like. That's one. The other is the Cornell Sheep and Goat Association, which is in September. We went there, learned a great deal about the real the mechanics and the medicine side of raising sheep, and then visiting people who are doing it.
Can I just chip in there?
Please, James.
I think Peggy said something really smart. Whenever you talk to people that have they've succeeded in becoming part of a sort of shepherding way of life, a common thread that runs through it all is one of respect for people who already do it.
Yeah.
So it's way harder than you might imagine. There's a million things you have to learn. The smart way to do it is to ask a lot of questions of people that know what they're doing. And when I heard Peggy talking, it reminded me of Beatrix Potter, who, when she first came to the Lake District, thought she was going to do it her way. And to her very great credit, quickly realized that there were people who devoted generations to understanding the mountains and how you farm this particular breed of sheep and how you do these things well. And to her very great credit, she hired a really good shepherd, and she went on to be very successful showing our particular breed of sheep. And it was all because of a sort of mutual respect between her and the people that had been doing it a long time, and it worked for both sides.
Beatrix Potter, of course, of Peter Rabbit fame, whose fortune from that helped set aside, buy and set aside so much land that you now use. James Rebanks writes that he tells a story about the people who get forgotten in the modern world, about how we need to open our eyes and see the forgotten people who live in our midst, whose lives are often deeply traditional and rooted in the past. Those not so common, but maybe more common in his neck of the world, and not only yours. Peggy Allen diving back into it from the modern world with her husband Todd at Savage Heart Farm in Hartford, Vermont. Peggy, thank you for joining us for a couple of minutes today, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Good luck, Peggy. Good luck.
Thank you.
James, what do you hope people take away from your story?
I would like them to look again at some of the historic places that they visit. I don't want them all to become shepherds, really. I think that's not really the point. I think as we travel around the world increasingly as tourists and other things, we go to many, many other people's landscapes, and I would like people to think a little bit more about who's already there and what they do and what their culture is and what their ways of life are, because it's not only richer for the tourists, but it helps to keep those things going and leaves the world a better place, I think.
Well, your book put me back on the farm in a big way, in a wonderful way. It's beautifully rendered, beautifully observed, and we're grateful to you for the work and for sharing it so intimately. James Rebanks, author of The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape, with us today from Cumbria in the far northwest of England. James, thank you very much, and best of luck with your flock.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all the support.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.